Okay, good evening. Welcome, everybody. My name is Iris Borowy. I am one of the directors of the Center for the History of Global Development, which I'm running together with my colleague, Tony McGrew. And this is one of our Thursday seminars, and I'm very happy, delighted actually, to welcome Professor Mark Frey. Because this is the first time that we actually meet, even if it's only via Zoom, but that's better than nothing. So I'm really very much looking forward to this event here. Professor Frey is professor of contemporary history and history of international relations at the Bundeswehr University. That's the University of the German Armed Forces. They actually have a university, and I'm always very happy that they have such wonderful professors as Professor Frey in Munich. And before he was there, he worked at many places, including the Jacobs University in Bremen, which, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe is one of the two private universities we have in Germany. Is that correct?
Yes, more or less.
Okay, I'm going to ask him later on what more or less means. Anyway, it's a private university. Then there's the University of Münster. He was also a fellow at the German Historical Institutes too in London and in Washington. He was also at the Center of Advanced Studies of National University at Singapore. So he has not been in Shanghai, but he's certainly been sort of in the vicinity, at least in Asia. And also at the Woodrow Wilson Center in DC. So that is a very prestigious file. I'm missing a word here. His background is really in Dutch and US foreign policy. And I'm very happy to finally have an opportunity to thank him for having written the best survey book on the Vietnam War that I know and that I've used repeatedly with a lot of success in classes. And both times I was really, really happy to have this book. That was really immensely helpful. But he has, in recent times, he has shifted towards the history of colonialism, of post-colonialism, and of development, which is why we have invited him here to the Center of History of Development. So recent projects have included colonialism and international law, elites in India, development beyond industrialization, and I believe the most recent edited volume together with Corinna Unger, who spoke at this seminar here last summer, I believe it was in June, on the global history of urban development. So I don't want to talk too long and rob too much of his time. So I'll mention just that was the global history of urban development. Then there is the book International Organizations and Development, published in 2014, where he was one of the co-editors. And some of you may know this because I've also used this in some classes. And the most recent publication, the special issue of Comparative on Rural Development. Whatever other questions you have for him, you can ask later. Just before I open the floor, let me introduce also the discussant of tonight. That's Elorum Kuma. I believe most of you will know her, who was a student at Shanghai University, but graduated last summer with a very good thesis on the Chat Sea, on exactly the area that we're talking about, and the interconnections between the political, environmental, and economic repercussions of this development, and who has now founded, created her own trading company. So one of the not so many people who ends studying history and then goes into business. So she will be the discussant. So as usual, we will listen to Professor Frey first and to Elon with her comments, and then afterwards we'll open up the floor to everybody. So the floor is all yours, Professor Frey.
Well, first of all, thank you very much, Iris Borovi, for the kind introduction and the invitation. I mentioned earlier in German that I've never been to China, actually. So this is my first opportunity to speak, not to a particularly Chinese audience, but at least it has some connection to a place in China, Shanghai University. So thanks very much. Thank you also, Elon, for suffering while reading my paper. I'm looking forward to comments. And thank you all for being here. I have the chat function on, so if the connection is somewhat unstable or you have difficulties following me, then please write a message, then I'll, you know, then we'll see what we need to do. I will also look to my right side, that's to, I guess, to your left, from your perspective. I have a couple of notes here to which I need to go to occasionally. So I apologize, you know, looking all the time into the camera, and a final apology for my possibly poor at a very German institution. It's almost all our German officers. Now, many of them come from, you know, from migrant backgrounds, third, second generation. And we also have officers from a couple of African countries in particular, from Ghana, from Benin, Togo. They need to learn German first, so I hardly ever have the opportunity nowadays to speak in English. I'll share a couple of slides with you. Iris, could you perhaps?
Hang on.
Now you can see it.
Yeah. We can see it, yeah.
Okay, excellent. Good. Okay. Good. Now I can't see my chat, but I guess it's up there. Okay, good. So if something goes wrong technically, let me know. So the topic of my presentation is the Office du Niger in Mali. It's an irrigation project in the interior delta of the River Niger. We'll have a look at the region. and I think with my mouse, I can show you where it is. Here is the Niger. That's about 300 kilometers northeast of the capital of Mali, Bamako. And Bamako and is about 750 kilometers away from the nearest port city, Dakar. And there is a train connection here built in the late colonial period. now, why am I interested in the Office du Niger, and why do I hope that I can sort of share my fascination for the topic with you? Is because it's at least to me, an excellent example of a large development project, which has more or less 100 years of history. And it's very, I think it very, it's very good for studying, you know, developments in the field of development over a long period of time. In particular, I'm interested in the following questions. How and why did development start in the colonial period? How can it be characterized? What are the differences to post-colonial development? The differences, but also the continuities, so to speak. The second question I'm trying to deal with is, can one detect certain outcomes in a project influenced by changing doctrines. So to put it in a nutshell, do doctrines and theories of development matter? And I'll hope to show that they do, and you're probably aware of that from other examples. And the third question is why and how do priorities change over time? So I use this as a kind of case study to try to show larger trends, so to speak, in the history of rural development. Here we approach the region from a less distant perspective. You see here Niono, one of the centers of the Office du Niger, Ségou, where the headquarters of the Office du Niger are located. So it's specifically here and a little bit there. it's a large area. I'll go into that in a moment. And it's located, as you can see, in the semi-arid region of the Sahel in West Africa. My small project, so to speak, is part of a larger project. Corinna Unger, who you met last year, and I kind of directed, so to speak, over a couple of years from 2014 to 2020 at Jacobs University in Bremen. Here you see the team, Corinna standing next to me, and then the PhD students who worked on a couple of projects. and the final PhD was submitted last year, so the project ended. It was funded by a German foundation, the Volkswagen Foundation, with about $700,000, so roughly speaking. now, perhaps we'll start with just a few impressions of how it looks like. Above on your left, you see a canal and you see a rice field. Below, you see women farmers working in the dry rice fields. Above, there is a common mode of transportation. And below on your right, you see a construction work going on. A new canal is being built. It's a very complex system, naturally, with various kind of categories of canals, larger and smaller ones. It's from an engineering point of view, it's quite complex because of the high temperature in this region. the water needs to flow in a certain with a certain speed, so to speak. That makes it very complex also to maintain. There are other large projects, irrigation projects. You might know one in the Sudan, the so-called Gezira scheme, which is even larger than the Office du Niger and even a little older, which also lends itself very nicely to look at agricultural development over a long period of time. I selected the Office because it was less well researched than the Gezira scheme. And when I was at the Wilson Center in Washington a long time ago, actually 2011, there was a kind of discussion group which introduced me to this to this project. here again on the left, on the right, you see rice. Then above the canal again with predominantly women farmers. On your left above, a ewing machine at work and women in the field. These photographs were taken by my doctoral student, Diabou Barry. She came from, or she comes from Senegal, and she did a PhD on women in the Office du Niger from the time of independence, 1960s, up to the present, and she conducted field work. I'm an armchair traveler, I must admit. I've never been to Mali, so I depend in part certainly on her research. My research on the Office du Niger focused very much on the interaction between the World Bank and the Malian government. So my point of departure, so to speak, was a study I never fully turned into something written on multi-governance in development. Yeah, here's a fact sheet just to introduce you to what this is all about. You see the land development in hectares over time. You see that it has grown significantly, both in the colonial period and then in the post-colonial period. You see rice yields per hectare have gone up over the last couple of decades significantly. And fortunately, so to speak, this was over a long period of time a serious problem, the low rice yields, because up until the 1990s, the project was, at least in financial terms, not really running very well. That is, the input, the financial input was higher than the output. The number of settlers you see here as well, especially in recent decades, it has increased significantly. This has certainly also environmental reasons. Many settlers from outside the Office du Niger, especially from the Sahel area, to the Office du Niger because it seemed to provide much greater security and better livelihoods for the majority of the people living in the area. And you see the number of employees here. You see that in the late colonial period, and that goes well into the 1980s, there is a relatively large number of staff. And I'm pointing to that a little more when we when I move on. But since the late 1990s, or mid-1990s, the number of employees has been reduced significantly, and it's now more or less, it conforms to the prerequisites, more or less, of the international donor community that requested a significant restructuring of the project in connection with structural adjustment. Now, it all begins, so to speak, in the year 1919 with an engineer by the name of Émile Bellim. Émile Bellim is requested by the French colonial government in Dakar to investigate this area, more or less primarily for the reason to search for grounds to produce cotton. During the First World War, cotton, the textile industry in France had suffered tremendously. The French government after the war was in search of making itself independent from international markets, Britain and the United States in particular. So Émile Bellim traveled to the River Niger, and there he found the solution, so to speak. This interior delta in the area, and he suggested plan and build this irrigation scheme on a very large area, two-thirds the size of Belgium. So a quite significant area. On the right, you see his left, and excuse me, you more or less see his recommendations, and on the right, a subsequent publication where he kind of shows his plans and maps in much more detail. Now, the French colonial administration was kind of quite excited about this because the area is not very fertile. It's actually not an area which is from a kind of economic perspective really very productive. And so from a colonial perspective, it kind of made sense to do this. Politicians in Paris were not so sure about it because they were afraid of the high investments, but the colonial government in Dakar went along anyway, and then opened up on a small piece, so to speak, the Office du Niger in 1932. That is at the beginning of the French economic crisis, so to speak, which the global economic crisis, which started in 1929, but which came to France somewhat later, starting in 1932. Villages had to be built, as you can see here, and the whole scheme had to be laid out. Now, here are some other photos taken from a propaganda publication, one could say, publicizing the achievements of the Office du Niger here in 1940. You can see that, you know, all kinds of things had to be built, dams. You see here on the left, a village road, and also a medical center. Actually, in 1940, was not yet there. Settlers were treated very badly. A commentator who drove to the office in the late 1930s felt reminded of a kind of slavery system. It was more or less a forced labor camp. The settlers who were there had not gone voluntarily, but had all been selected by village elders or village heads on the command of the French. So they were not really happy there. The population who had lived there had been pastoralists who were forced to leave the area. So violence is very much a significant factor in the evolution of the Office du Niger. And that also interested me to what degree, you know, violence was there over a long period of time, maybe there today. In the sense, or the way I use violence here is not only physical violence, but I'm following here Johann Galtung's concept of the structural violence, the conditions which are imposed on the individual that are severely limiting their capacity to make their choices on their own. That's what I mean here. So basically a forced labor camp up until World War II. The French also publicized achievements in inverted commas, so to speak, also in a movie which was shown around the time of the occupation by German troops. Here you see some stills. So these are not actors, but real, you know, settlers, so to speak, and sharp contrast, I would say, between the promises of colonial development, that's the vision of mise en valeur, of enhancement in a way, for both the colonizers and the colonized, a vision which was not only popular in the 1920s in France, but also even earlier with the Dutch in Indonesia, the so-called ethical policies starting in the early 1900s, but also in the British Empire, you might know Frederick Lugard, a governor in northern Nigeria, who was not only the theorist, so to speak, of indirect rule, but also made this important differentiation between exploitation and development. And following this, so to speak, European powers in the 1920s, colonial powers in the 1920s, felt a certain need, at least rhetorically, to highlight also the positive benefits of exploitation and development for colonized people. But the reality is certainly different. It's a labor camp. Fees, water fees in particular, are so high that that the farmers become indebted to the institution. That means they cannot leave. They work under a legal system which discriminates against them very heavily, and which is abolished only after World War II. So there is a clear kind of discrepancy between the promises of late colonial development and the reality on the ground. Now, World War II is really a watershed for development, but also, as you know, for decolonization. And it's especially soldiers which come home, for instance, to Ghana or to Senegal, hundreds of thousands of African soldiers who fight for Britain, who fight for France. They fight for democracy. They fight against fascism, dictatorship. They fight for freedoms. They've all heard about the Atlantic Charter, so to speak. And they come home and they are confronted with a system which discriminates against them, which treats them as second-class citizens, and which does not deliver the promises the colonial powers had made, that they can uplift people, that they bring civilization, and so forth. So what happens after World War II is that this kind of plays out, for instance, in Ghana, in a general strike in the late 1940s and in strikes in urban areas all over the place in Africa. In the countryside, that's somewhat different, certainly, because, you know, the countryside is not as integrated into information markets as are the rapidly mushrooming cities of Africa. You know, when you think of Nairobi, for instance, which doubled in the number of inhabitants during the period between 1940 and 1945, Mombasa, Lagos, etc. So there is really a kind of urban explosion. This is not, you know, this is something else in the countryside, but it does have an effect also on the Office du Niger. The colonial powers treat after the Second World War in a way which I've termed a second colonial occupation. They are aware that they need the economic resources of Africa to reconstruct their countries, but they are also aware that they need to invest in Africa, in order to legitimize continued colonial rule. And that is something which also reaches the Office du Niger in the form of, for instance, better medical infrastructure, schools are opened, and so forth. I mentioned the legal code which discriminates against Malians or against, you know, colonial subjects in the French Empire. And this is abolished in 1945, and the effect is really great on the Office du Niger. There are 20,000 settlers there, most of them who had not come voluntarily, and many of them leave the Office du Niger. So what basically happens is that about a third of the settlers are gone. And in terms of labor, this creates a huge problem. And the solution to that is seen in mechanization. Mechanization is a big topic in, you know, the history of agriculture of the late colonial period in Africa as a whole. You can see here on below spare pods in the Tanganyika, of the Tanganyika groundnuts scheme, a huge area where the British colonial government tried to do groundnut farming, basically, and it all ended within a few years in this catastrophe, so to speak. And also in the Office du Niger, which you see above, mid-1950s, tractors have arrived. Heavy machines, they're not suited for the soil, so to speak, because the fertile soil is relatively thin, and these heavy machines compact the soil so that the seeds cannot grow. This is being realized in the late 1950s, and the Office du Niger management goes back to oxens and human work. But for the 1950s, it's very typical that you can see this large-scale effort to mechanize African agriculture on a grand scale. I'm just looking at my notes to see whether I haven't left something out. I guess not, but I wanted to have the just to give you a kind of more detailed illustration what this means, mechanization. It might be different in the Tanganyika groundnut scheme, but it's typical for French West Africa, and particularly for the interior. You know, remember Bamako or Ségou is about 1,000 kilometers away from the nearest port city. So what happens, the French are also, you know, not so rich in the early 1950s. They appreciate very much the financial assistance of the Marshall Plan. And with the Marshall Plan comes American machinery, and later on then French machinery. What happens is by the end of the decade, the Office owned about 120 tractors, and you see one of them here. But these are 15 different models, totally different from each other. And all in all, 21 could still be used. Spare parts were hard to get. They were extremely expensive, and so forth. So basically, neither the soil condition nor the infrastructure and the logistics were conducive to the mechanization which you see here. We are at the same time now at the end of the colonial period. Mali becomes independent, and the Office du Niger is in a way emblematic of the process by which decolonization was undertaken. You see here on your right a typed report by a French consulting company on the Office du Niger submitted to the very new independent Malian government in late 1960. And in this report, the engineers, they describe the project, they describe what the situation is on the ground. They point to the heavy deficiencies, to the very high investments which are needed to increase yields, to promote the site as a fertile ground, so to speak, for farmers to move in. They more or less, the report more or less, reflects to a certain degree the way in which the Europeans, left the colonies with some advice, certainly, with certainly also with investments, but definitely not enough. And it's like, we go, here's the report, do what you like, have a good time. And this is with this is what the Malian government is now confronted with. The Malian government of the 1960s opts for a socialist solution, but it accords the Office du Niger really a great significance. Over the 1960s and 1970s, the Office du Niger absorbs about 10% of the Malian finances, public finances. So it's by far the single most important investment, development project in Mali. And it's symbolized here on stamps and on, money, basically. These new post-colonial visions reveal a very high degree with the colonial period. The managers of the Office du Niger, as well as the, the employees and the state ministries in Bamako, they are all educated by the French. They come from urban areas. Some may have studied in France. They have little connection to the countryside. Or if they have, they want to kind of cut this connection because they are now the new urban elite. And that means that they treat the settlers in much the same way as the French did. The Office du Niger is not about providing people with choices, providing families with good living. It's about production. And this is the only thing that counts. It's only production. and that means that modernization has to be forced in part upon farmers which are seen as traditionalists, as obstacles to modernity in a way. In the Office du Niger, that means that that about 50% of the workers are now salaried workers, so they no longer work the land they rent. There is no privacy, private lots, so to speak. So the farmers all rent their farmland, usually for one or two or three seasons. But in 1960s, socialist Mali, the idea is to work the land with salaried workers to make the socialist vision in a way concrete. But that means that they're that the farmers are very much kind of the victims of the Office du Niger. The vast majority of them lives in a state of debt peonage, so to speak. It's impossible to leave. They are evicted if they do not deliver what the Office du Niger demands in terms of the yields and so forth. And it's very much continuity. There are also early donors here now in the 1960s. They're the French there, certainly, but also the European Union moves in on very low level, but still, and especially Chinese. All over Africa in the 1960s, Chinese expertise, especially in agriculture, is in great demand. And particularly rice certainly is something, and the Chinese advised to move to transplanted rice in the 1960s. This is not really successful in the Office du Niger because it's very demanding in terms of work and time. Sowing is basically done by women. If the women are concerned with transplanting rice, they no longer can, produce plant vegetables and so forth. So this is not an idea which is taken up in the 1960s, but it comes up again in the 1990s. By the end of the 1960s, a first World Bank a report on the Office du Niger says the checkered history of the Office du Niger and the very limited output achieved after more than three decades of trial and error and the investment of substantial capital illustrate many of the pitfalls of planning and managing a large-scale scheme of this kind. And you could also say this for the Gezira scheme. Here you see one of the office buildings that's more present photograph, certainly. At the time, I think it looked more or less the same. You see it's not in a perfect condition. So this World Bank report also illustrates the fact that the Western donor community in the 1960s was very reluctant to invest in agricultural projects all over Africa. There is investment in ports and infrastructure, as you know. There is some urban development, but there is very little in agriculture. Even in the colonial period, some projects were funded by the World Bank, but that's in the plantation economy, so to speak, export-oriented plantation economy, but not in a project like this in the Office du Niger, where the farmers have moved just recently, so to speak, from cotton, which is unproductive in this area, to rice. That's in the late 1960s, where cotton is abolished. And rice becomes the thing. It's for food security in Mali and something for to earn some exports. But this is kind of indicative of this assessment by the World Bank of the Office du Niger, indicative of the overall, so to speak, low appreciation of agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa in the 1960s. Now, what really changed all this, and I mentioned this earlier, is an environmental and human catastrophe, the droughts of the 1970s. This really brings many pastoralists into the Office du Niger because there is water and they become farmers. And this is really seen now, the Office du Niger, as a very promising area to live. But still, if one looks at the promises, so to speak, of the original plan of the Office du Niger, and also the promises of socialist African socialism in Mali in the 1960s, there is a huge discrepancy. There's a literacy rate of under 5%. So there are basically no schools. The annual per capita income is as low as it is in the rest of the country. Although significant investments have been made. Structural violence is endemic. There is a police force, and now I come back to the number of employees. There is a huge police force, basically, which preys upon the settlers, kind of demands the yearly contributions of rice, which dictates how to organize anything. So basically, it's still, to some degree, a large labor camp. And the settlers who live in the area, the settlers themselves, describe themselves well into the 1980s as slaves. Now, what brings attention to African agriculture from the late 1960s on are a number of changes, both in terms of doctrines of development and the operational aspects, so to speak. In terms of doctrine, it's you might know this, is an appreciation the subsistence farmer in the early 1960s. That is, economists find out that subsistence farming is actually profitable and good for the families, and that one should support it if possible. And the second thing is the operationalization, so to speak, by the World Bank from the late 1960s on. And that goes in particular for Felix, my son is at home and he wanted something. And that goes in particular for McNamara, Robert S. McNamara, who assumes the presidency of the World Bank in 1968, who's driven by concerns about rural areas. He is very much concerned about the connection between rural areas and rural poverty. This is something he experienced while directing the war in Vietnam. And he sees a chance now, you know, to ameliorate this problem on a global scale in a way, particularly in Africa. So the World Bank starts investing in numerous projects in the 1970s, especially in rural areas in sub-Saharan Africa. Infrastructure, feeder roads so that people can access markets, and a variety of things, you know. So there's really, you know, first, from the perspective of the doctrine in the early 1960s, and then from strategic and political relations, then in the 1970s, an appreciation of the rural countryside in Africa. Now, the successes of this area are mixed. There is, at least for the economists, there is no tangible success. For the people who can now move much easier to markets or who have wells in their villages, it's something else. But from simply from a financial economic perspective, it's not really something which one sees, so to speak, visibly. And by the end of the 1970s, there is a great disillusionment with rural development. I'd like to point to only one report which really influenced the larger development community, and that's, and you might know it, that's the famous De Burgh report of 1989, commissioned by the World Bank. Basically, the report blames African governments for past failures in agriculture and continued rural poverty, and not the legacy of colonialism. And so in a way, the report says, you know, this is all mismanagement, what you've done since 1960, since independence. And it's your fault, so to speak, and not the fault of any, you know, externalities, global markets, the legacies of colonialism, the deficiencies of colonialism, and so forth. So it calls the report for market-oriented trade, exchange rate policies, and so forth. And this then, you know, develops over time into a more comprehensive program of structural adjustment. I guess you're familiar with structural adjustments, deregulation, so to speak, the freeing of market forces, so to speak, in Africa. And here the Office du Niger comes into view, certainly because it's a parastatal, it's run by the Malian government in the end, it's financed by the Malian government, and it has a lot of staff. And that's certainly something donors don't like to see in this new environment of the Burke Report. And the disillusionment with past investments in the 1970s. So you've read what the donors call for. I think I have another, yeah. The results are mixed, I think. Here you see, a quote from a study by an anthropologist undertaken in the mid-1980s on the farmers in the Office du Niger. And that's the quote, by a farmer, our country has been free since 1960, but we farmers in the Office are still the agency's slaves. The results are mixed, I think. And it's very difficult, so to speak, to really analyze the effects of structural adjustment on rural areas. It has been mainly done on urban areas, and there the direction is quite clear. Food prices went up, food security decreased, And structural adjustment as a whole made life more difficult for urban dwellers. In the countryside, it's very different because in the Office du Niger, the staff is downsized. The police force is abolished. Farmers have more freedom. Their lease contracts are longer. The office now allows also what previously had been more or less not really legal, women farmers to grow vegetables. And that's very important, the vegetables, because it has an impact on gender relations and on also on the family income. I'll come to that in a moment. So structural adjustment actually in the Office du Niger probably brought more advantages than disadvantages, at least from a farmer's perspective. Now the current emphasis is in development, is certainly still on institutions and governance, you know, good government. It's still about disseminating norms and influencing behavior. It's more than ever on providing a conducive environment for individual activity. In the Office du Niger, that translates, for instance, I mentioned the vegetables in a large-scale production nowadays of vegetables, predominantly by female farmers who sell their produce on local and regional markets and thereby contribute to the family income. Family incomes for settlers in the Office du Niger have gone up, at least for two-thirds of the farmers. They are now higher than on the national average. One would think that structural adjustment and the legacy of it has been conducive in terms of gender relations. And that is something Diana Wu has told me, and she wrote about that in her dissertation, have changed on the level of the economic level, certainly. There, women have achieved more freedom, so to speak, and they can also buy things for themselves. But in social and cultural terms, relations apparently have not changed much. The site or in the Office Tunisia, polygamy is, for instance, very widespread for economic reasons and also in part for cultural reasons. And some women seem to find this a good way of, you know, living as a family, a larger family. Some don't, so the opinions are deeply divided, I think. But this would have been much more difficult before structural adjustment. So, to summarize this briefly, a need for planning is certainly something which is deeply ingrained in the Office du Niger, since its planning and inception in the 1920s and 30s, and nowadays planning is still necessary. It's a huge irrigation scheme, and planners are absolutely vital. So there is a long continuity, and it's also top down. It needs to be top down because there needs to be a decision making element which kind of directs all the complexes, flows of water, and so forth. Violence or structural violence has certainly changed and decreased over time, but settlers are still not allowed to buy the land, so they still rent the land, and this points actually to a very significant problem, so to speak, in African agriculture as a whole. Much of the land is not really private land. I mean, many farmers own their land, but documentation is a serious problem. So when somebody comes and says, well, we evict you because we now set up a large scale plantation thing, it's very difficult for individual farmers to protest and to sue in court. So structural violence in the Office du Niger is still there because there is not really a long-term security for the settlers. And we've seen this since 2010, first a Libyan company and now various Chinese companies are there to utilize the land to basically, create large farms for exports to the detriment of individual farmers. The role of technology, capital, science, and knowledge is absolutely vital over the whole period of time. That's clear. And when one looks at the life of the settlers, which is nowadays for two-thirds better than on average in Mali, but they're still certainly seen as the labor factor in a larger economic vision, so to speak. They're not seen as stakeholders, or families are not viewed upon, you know, from the point of view of the individual. So what I wanted to address are these changes, but also the continuities over time. And I hope that some of the issues I've tried to make have become a little bit clearer. I thank you for your attention, and I'm looking forward to comments and questions. Thank you.